Hi, this is Danielle from The Jealous Curator, and this is episode 118 of Art for Your Ear. You know what I'm going to say next? Yes, you're right. Today's episode is supported by Saatchi Art, the world's largest curated online gallery offering original art by independent artists from around the world. Visit them and buy some art at saatchiart.com. So, today's artist is a super duper busy guy. In fact, I honestly did not have it in me to research him properly. Books and speaking gigs and a podcast and illustration jobs with huge clients like Nickelodeon, and he's a dad on top of all of that. Yep, today I am talking to Andy J. Miller, also known as Andy J. Pizza. Why the pizza? I have no idea, but we're about to find out. Ready? Here we go. Calling Mr. Pizza. Hey, Andy.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. It's been a whirlwind of a few weeks leading up to the holiday season, but I'm kind of like, you know, amped, so I'm feeling pretty good.
Where are you exactly?
Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, okay, that's what I thought. And so have you been busy with like work stuff or just like children's stuff or everything?
Mostly work. Work has been, I guess, I feel like at the beginning of the year in illustration and then speaking and all that, I feel like you get a lot of super cool jobs that don't have crazy budgets because they're, you know, they just started the year and they don't want to waste their budget. But then at the end of the year, it's not that they're not cool jobs, but they're like last minute crazy jobs and they have good budgets, but they all come in like October, November, December. So it's just been crazy.
Go, go, go. Okay, well, before we get to all that, because we will... Yeah. There's a lot to get to because I started researching all your stuff and then I got tired because I was like,
I try to be entertaining.
He has so much stuff though. And so I was like, I don't even know. So I'm just going to wind you up and let you go. So first of all, Andy, let's start with the pizza situation. Why pizza?
This question every once in a while. So I've become known as Andy J. Pizza. And it's kind of a tricky situation, okay? Because I do have kind of a problem with pizza, and that I am deeply obsessed with it. I feel like for whatever reason, it doesn't hit me the same as any other food. So I can eat like an infinite amount of pizza, and I never get full. And
that is trouble.
It is definitely trouble.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, about 3 years ago, I went on a diet, and so my pizza consumption has been very low for 3 years. But about 3 years ago is when I actually registered the domain name andyj.pizza, and I just did it, even though I do super love pizza, but I mainly did it because I couldn't get a good domain name with the last name Miller. So my domain name was andy-j-miller.com, which was like ridiculous to say.
Yeah.
And they launched those new domain names. And so I snatched up .pizza just thinking it would be a good domain name. And then every person in my professional career started calling me Andy J. Pizza. And the rest is history. I can't. So it's funny because it's probably more accurate name now would be Andy J. Salad. But there is no dot salad. And
I didn't even know there was a dot pizza.
Yeah, I don't know, a few years ago, they released, like, a crazy amount of suffixes for domains.
Oh, and you jumped on it.
Jumped on it, man, yeah.
And so when you get illustration jobs, do people refer to you as Andy J. Pizza?
For the most part, yeah.
Almost every,
I mean, the cool thing is, like, in terms of social media and branding, like, Andy J. Pizza is, like, infinitely more memorable than Andy J. Miller. And so,
sure,
it's worked out, even though I feel like I'm living a lie in a way.
Yeah. And does it taunt you? Does it make you think, oh God, now I could really go for some pizza every time somebody calls you that?
Pretty much. I feel the pressure. I went and spoke at the art school in Chicago last year, and they were taking me to all those deep dish Chicago places.
No.
Like, I'll have half a slice. And they're like, what? Like, your name's Andy J. Pizza. What are you doing? You're messing around. Yeah, it's kind of a dark. Like if you're an alcoholic and you call yourself Andy J. Beers, and then
yeah.
you know, you quit drinking. Like, that's what I feel like all the time. I got known for my, you know, my bad days off the wagon or on the wagon, whichever one it is.
Like, that is so funny. So are you doing like a no gluten situation? Is that why?
No, it's just a low calorie thing.
And, yeah,
and
yeah.
I do like the by the slice situation.
Yeah.
Because I like to eat all the pizza that someone gives me.
Yeah, you don't want to be rude.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, not even that. I just enjoy it. And when I have one slice, I feel like I've eaten the whole thing, but it's just one slice. Whereas, you know, you order a pie.
You got to eat the whole thing.
Yeah. Man.
This is the psychology of pizza.
I know.
By Andy J. Pizza. Okay, so I was going to say, this was going to be my awesome segue into your childhood. So how do your parents feel about the fact that you have replaced their namesake with pizza?
I would say, first of all, my dad is probably proud of me. I feel like the Miller name is sort of infamous. He's done a really good job of like elevating the Miller name, but without going into deep detail, I feel like I've kind of set up this conversation in a weird way, but the Miller family is kind of notorious in more than one way.
Now you're opening a whole door.
I don't know. You know, it's a tricky thing. You know, my dad was the first one to go to college in his family. Their family had, they kind of came. I don't know anything about Kentucky, all right? I know a lot of good people from Kentucky, but I know that his dad came from like the backwoods Kentucky and some kind of crazy times. And so his whole journey was like to elevate the Miller name. And, you know, he's always saying like, he's always trying to come up with new traditions for the Millers that are productive and help you be a contributing member of society. I think he probably thinks it's all right if I distance myself from it a little bit. This is a terrible thing to say. I'm sorry, aunts and uncles out there. I know we're all trying our best, but
that is hilarious. You just got yourself in a whole lot of trouble over this Christmas.
I know.
Well, you know what? They're not going to listen to it. Will they?
No, probably
not. Okay, we're safe. Okay, so let's talk about you when you were little. Were you drawing comic books? Were you what were you like?
Yeah, I you know, I grew up with my dad and my older brother, and it was kind of a tricky situation because my mom was the artsy one, but she kind of split the scene when I was like 1 or 2 years old, and my dad and my brother are like the sports math people.
Oh yeah.
And whatever that is, I'm the opposite of that. And so they were always playing basketball. So my dad would coach high school basketball, and I would just take like sketchbooks and draw and be in my own universe playing X-Men and drawing X-Men and drawing Ninja Turtles and that's kind of like all the stuff I was doing all the time. And, you know, I remember like sticking my head in the couch because I was so aggravated that all they ever watched was basketball. And,
it's like a little ostrich in the sand.
Yeah, exactly. Just like, oh, I can't watch any more basketball. And, but you know, it was really tricky because, not to get too heavy from the get go, I've kind of shared this on my podcast a little bit, but, you know, early on, the only person that I had in my life that had creativity or kind of reminded me of myself was my mom. And early on in my life, I was like thrilled about that because I thought she was the coolest person in the world, even though I didn't see her that much. And she was also an artist, visual artist, had done a bunch of sketches for kids' books that she wanted to make and logos and all kinds of stuff. And when I was really little, all of the people in my life, like my aunts and uncles, would always say that I was just like my mom. And it made me super happy, although she wasn't around, so that made me really sad. But then by the time I was a teenager, I can see that I've like sucked out the air out of this digital room.
No, I love it. I love that you're not just goofing around. Tell me the stuff.
Sorry.
No, it's good.
This is just kind of like the relevant thing about me being a kid. And And I'm, you know, I'm pretty open book. But I, so when I was a kid, I loved being told that I was just like her. But as I got older, like in my teenage years, and I realized, like, none of this spark that I have from my mom is helping me in school. It's not helping me in sports. It's not helping me at, you know, my part-time job. Like, I can't do the cash register properly, and I get super fed up by being in that cashier's box for 8 hours, and, you know, I don't want to keep this job. And so as I get older, like, it become this kind of thing of, like, you're just like her becomes more of, like, a curse than a blessing. Mm. And I'm also, like, watching her life unfold into tragedy after tragedy that she's kind of brought on herself. She leaves, you know, another family and gets into a whole mess of trouble, you know, in whatever ways you could imagine, basically. And so watching her and knowing that I am a lot like her from a young age ended up being kind of like a prophetic vision of doom over my future. And it even so much so, this is outrageous, but it's kind of funny. When I was in high school, before I really discovered illustration and design, I had no idea what I was going to do for a living because I hated my part-time job. I didn't like school. And I just thought I didn't have any examples of something that someone like me could do and actually be like a contributing member of society. And I remember thinking that, like, my plan B, I mean, it was kind of my plan A because I didn't have any other plan, but my plan B was going to be, at worst case scenario, it's so ridiculous, but I just remembered it recently. In the back of my mind, I thought I could pretend to go crazy and then let me stay at some kind of hospital and probably, you know, like, I don't know, medicate me, and I'll just be silly, be crazy, and just, like, be up, try to figure out how to enjoy my life that way. And it's ridiculous. And I'm sure I was kind of joking, but I'm sure there's a part of me that thought, like, maybe that could be an option. Like, I was always into acting, so maybe I could see if I could pull off that role.
Sure, why not? Nice cozy bed. They give you meals.
Yeah,
my son said to me when he was about four, when my son was four, he said, we were watching something, some cartoon that must have had a jail on it or something.
Yeah.
And he said, Mommy, jail seems like a cozy little place. And I was like, and he's just like, but you get your own bed and you have some friends there and they bring you food and you don't have to have a job. And I was like, whoa.
Okay. Like, it reminds me of the uncle on Back to the Future that, like, loves to be in its crib all the time.
And Uncle Joey. In jail. I know. That was, you know, Charlie, my son was heading down that same path. Looks like a sweet deal. Why wouldn't you do it? Uncle, so at what point did you end up going to school for illustration?
So what ended up happening, I was planning on going to the community college in my town and going into graphic design. In high school, I discovered graphic design and illustration through band posters and stuff. I ended up getting super into music. And so I thought I could go to this community college and do design there. They had a little design program. But right when I was graduating, my dad got a transfer in his job to move to the UK the year I graduated. So I got to go study over there. And I went to what would be like the equivalent of a state school. So it wasn't technically art school. It was just like a program within like a state school or whatever.
Yeah.
And I studied illustration and design while I was there. And even though like the program, you know, I'm sure didn't have like tons of money or it wasn't like a main focus of this program, there were a few teachers and a handful of students that were freakishly amazing. And I still keep in contact with them. They've all gone on to do pretty incredible things in like design and illustration world. And so, you know, that little crew was enough to like spark that development that you need, you know, that community.
You must have just felt like finally, like none of them are watching basketball.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
They're just like you.
Yeah. Like nobody's watching sports. like that was my dream come true. And actually like, you know, I instantly became like top of the class for the first time ever. And that was definitely like a weird, you know, I always think about like, you hear stand-up comedians talk about, like Jerry Seinfeld talks about how when he first met stand-ups in a club, he was like, these are my people. I just want to be one of these people. And that's exactly how I felt. I just felt like I finally found my people.
Yeah. What a nice feeling after, you know, feeling kind of alone. Yeah, that's awesome. And okay, so, and that's crazy too, because I wonder if your dad hadn't been transferred, I wonder if you would have found the same kind of, I mean, you might have, because those are the people that signed up for the program, but, you know, it's kind of fortuitous that you ended up where you did.
I would say it definitely has that, that taste of destiny for me, because I don't know if I would have made it through an American school, because the great thing and really the like what sealed the deal wasn't that I wouldn't be around sports people, but that I wouldn't have to take math classes because there's no general studies in college there. And so I knew that I would be, if I went to England, that was the thing that persuaded me, is that I would only be taking design classes and illustration classes. And so I was like, I'm all in. So I spent three years just doing like, and the program was really loose. It was, I think it was in kind of a transitory time, and I was so passionate and motivated. But there was like not a ton of direction. So I basically spent 3 years, making cool stuff with my new friends.
Yeah.
And,
that's like awesome.
It was like going in the wilderness and just like making tons and tons of stuff.
And so what happened? Did you stay in the UK after you graduated?
Yeah. So so it was like right around the recession, and England was like hit pretty hard and there was no jobs. And so the only job I could get was I was, before I was an actual artist, I was a sandwich artist.
Yes.
And actually on more than one occasion, I got in trouble with the boss for getting too artistic with the sauces.
Oh,
I was doing twirly moves and they were like three lines, back, forth. And like, so I worked at Subway, and while I was there, this gal from a Subway across the town picked up a few shifts, and we fell in love over those cold cuts.
Oh, baby. How could you not?
Such a romantic smell, the Subway smell, just romantic vibe. And so I got married to a Brit, and had some kids. We had one kid while we were over there, and we moved back in 2010.
Wow. Okay. And so how old are your kids now?
I've got a 9-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 2-year-old.
Oh, my goodness.
Many Whoa. Children.
Yes, and a busy house.
A very busy house, yes. We are, you know, I think it's kind of, it's a lot of chaos, but it feels alive.
Yeah, I bet. Especially this time of year must be so fun.
Oh, yeah. It's bonkers.
Yeah, I'm sure.
My wife is a pretty, her whole family is like very into tradition and kind of holidays and all that. So we like, she, not only are we just like rammed full doing our own businesses and everything with all these kids, she like, you know, stacks up these holiday excursions. So we're constant. We never miss a thing. You know, in the pumpkin season, we're going to all the pumpkin patches, you know, doing all the decoration, all that stuff. And so, you know, holiday season is exactly the same. So we keep it pretty stacked.
That is hilarious. And so is she an artist too, or just a sandwich artist?
She is both. You can
okay.
be both.
Oh, well, I know. I now know that.
She was a sandwich artist. And she studied textile art, and she still does. Now she does it kind of more commercially, where she's making like products with felt and fabric. She does this this shop online called The Thread House, where she sells thousands of these wool felt animal ear headbands.
Oh,
and,
cool!
They're gorgeous. They're like, you know, she's like perfected them. They look like these minimal, sleek. It's like the best possible cat headband that you could get. It's like for the tasteful, you know, black cat and Halloween. But she just, I don't know, she's gotten super into it. She makes thousands of those things. And
that
so she's
is
still
awesome.
In that world. We're both very, I think we both have that artistic flair, but also a real interest in business and kind of making things happen. I think we both are really motivated in that way.
Yeah, well, there's another good segue. Okay, so you come back. You're mainly working as an illustrator when you came back?
Yeah, so that's good. That is a good question. So, like I said, every job I ever had, every actual job, so I have ADHD. So that's something we could talk about if you want. You might have already picked it up. It doesn't take very long. And it's not something I know how to hide. And so, you know, one of the things with ADHD is like my skin crawls when I'm, you know, in a cubicle for more than like an hour and a half or you know. I think the thing about ADHD is that if you're, and this is a crazy thing, and this is why I think it gets a lot of flack. If you're legitimately ADHD, you have a neurological condition. And one of the things that happens is if you're really interested in a subject, you can have insane tunnel vision. Mm-hmm. But if you're not, you can barely do it. It's like boredom for ADHD is basically pain. And it's not an exaggeration. So when I would work at these jobs that I like, hated every second of, I would leave every single day feeling physically ill. And so the whole time growing up, I'm thinking of how do I avoid traditional employment and still, you know, be a good dad and husband and, you know, contributing member of society? Like, is there some way around having a regular job? Because I just don't see myself being able to thrive or succeed in that way, because regular employment felt like being in jail to
me,
right?
Yeah.
So basically I graduate in 08 and every month I got a part-time job in graphic design while I was in the UK. We were still there. And for about 9 months, I made a little bit more money every month with freelance illustration. All the way until a year after I graduated, I got a really cool job for Starburst. And we used that money to launch into freelance and to move to the U.S. And, you know, I'd picked up a lot of momentum. I was featured on a bunch of blogs. I had a book in the works with Chronicle Books. I had all kinds of stuff going on. Only a year out of college. And I was like, oh, my goodness. Thank you. I'm not going to have a job where I'm going to be like crawling in my skin and, you know, it's going to work out, which I really needed it to because I'd taken a bunch of leaps of faith because I got a mortgage after that. We had a kid. I was married and I didn't have a job because I quit my job and went into freelance. And right at that time is like when the recession really hit the arts market.
Yeah.
And that was like 2009. And after I took the leap, things pretty much, after we moved back to the U.S., everything started to dry up for me. And I went like 6 months. No matter what I tried to do, I could not get an illustration job through the door. And so we banked everything on this continuing, and it just kind of dried up in front of us. And like, I was so destroyed by having like tasted my dreams, worked with some big clients, thought that, you know, I'd left this job and it was all going to be, you know, I was going to be living my dream. And then it all just like disintegrated, you know, overnight. And I was devastated to the point where I knew I had to go get a job, but I couldn't even bear to get a job in any type of creativity because I was so kind of upset. And so I got the only job I could get that wasn't minimum wage, which was at this youth shelter. And the youth shelter was, you know, it was a people-focused job. We're like working with teenagers that are displaced from their house for a bunch of different reasons, some of them kind of normal reasons, some of them really tragic reasons. And it felt really meaningful, which was better than like being a cashier working in retail in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And there was part of it that was really great. And I learned a lot. And it probably you know, probably impacted me going on to do the podcast and all kinds of other things. But ultimately, what I didn't realize when I took that job was that I was going to have to pick up shifts in the detention center that was connected to the shelter, which was the juvenile detention center, right?
Oh.
And so here I am, like, I'm like 3 years older than these kids that are in there.
And like pick up shifts, what does that mean? Like, what were you supposed to do there?
I had to like pick up, you know, like a 10-hour shift, go over to the other side of the building and basically go into a locked facility in a hall where there's like 10 or 12 juvenile delinquents. Some of them, you know, had really hard situations. Some of them are like arsonists and worse than that. And I'm like not a huge guy. Like every other person that worked there was like really big and kind of like, you know, like tough and, you know, no feelings. And I'm like cry at everything. Like every night I would go home to my wife, like so many nights I'd go home to my wife and just sob about these like terrible stories. And like, just, I was just not the ideal candidate. I'll say that. And so there I was like, you know, a year and a half out of school, you know, I'd spent the past 5 years trying to avoid traditional employment because it felt like jail.
And now you're in jail.
Working in jail. Yeah.
My God.
There was just like these extreme moments because you have to learn, because there's these horrible things that can happen, you know, whether they're going to hurt themselves or hurt somebody else. You're like really heavily trained to restrain someone if they're trying to hurt somebody. And so I'm in these like whole, like I'm helping hold a teenager from hurting somebody at like 3 a.m. in the morning, you know, a year after working with, you know, Starburst and Sony. And I'm like, so hopeless. I was like, you know, what the hell am I going to do with my life? Like, how did this happen?
Yeah, were you thinking about going to Plan B where you did the crazy guy thing again? It's like, okay, you don't need much motivation. You're almost there.
Yeah, honestly, yeah, I was almost there. And honestly, if I didn't have a kid, if I hadn't already had a kid and a wife and a house, I probably would have gone off the rails in a way deeper way. Because I was definitely at the bottom. But I always say that that rock bottom for me, like some people turn to like drugs or, you know, whatever. For me, at rock bottom, I turn to business books and marketing podcasts. That was rock bottom for the artist. Like it felt like the grossest thing in the world of like, now I'm going to go, you know, try to figure out how to get this business off the ground and listen to these gross marketing podcasts. They end up being they changed my life, and they're probably why I do what I do today and help other creatives do, you know, the same thing when they're in those crappy situations.
What year was that? 2011?
That was probably about 2011.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah. And so now, this is when I got tired. Okay. So, the podcast, books, and speaking all over the place, and still illustration jobs. And it's just like, how? Okay. Maybe your ADHD helps you with that, because I don't know how you do all the things that you do. Plus three kids. So, okay. I want to talk about, I don't even know what to talk about first. Like, that's what I was, when I was heading into this, I'm like, I don't even know where to start. So I kind of want to start, should we go chronologically?
Sure.
Which book happened first?
So the first book was the Indie Rock Coloring Book, and that was based off of a college project that I'd done. That kind of, the college project, I put it on my website. It was picked up by Pitchfork, and it ended up turning into a book with Chronicle Books. We ended up doing that book. We did the Indie Rock poster book after that, which was like a follow-up. We did, I did a dream journal with them. And then my last book with them was the Creative Pep Talk book.
Yeah, which looks so awesome.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm really proud of it. I've got like so many of my all-time favorite artists in there.
I know. Okay, so we're going to skip because this is new, right?
Yes, this came out last spring this spring.
And so there are some huge creative geniuses in that book. And so did you put the list? Because I've worked with Chronicle too, so I kind of, and I've had, you know, where I collect up a bunch of artists and stuff. So did you put like the ultimate list together and then approach people, or how did you get that crew? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't actually know why so many of them said yes. Like, I don't know. You know, I emailed, like, Stefan Sagmeister.
Yeah, I saw that.
He's never going to reply. And then, like, he was the first person. He's like, yeah, totally. Here's the image. You can have this, and we'll write up da-da-da-da. And I was like, what the heck? He's actually been incredibly, like, lovely and responsive throughout the whole process. Like, we had to do a few different things. And, yeah, like, you know, and then some of these people, when I was really young and stupid and didn't realize that you're not supposed to bug your heroes, you know, emailed, right out of college, I had like emailed tons of people that I thought were amazing. It was like early art on the internet days in a way. Like, I feel like it was still kind of blossoming in like, 2005, 2008. And a lot of those people, and I tell people this all the time, is like, a lot of those people, my relationship with them started by being a really pesky student guy. And it's funny how, like, over time, they kind of forget how they got to know you. And now a lot of those people are just my friends. Right. Even though, like, yeah, I definitely sent them, you know, homework of like, hey, could you please, like, give me feedback on my portfolio and all that crap. And so a lot of those people were people that I've kind of come to know over the past 10 years or so. People were just completely lovely. And I can't believe how many of my dream list ended up on that book.
Yeah. Name drop a little bit. Who's in there?
Let me just hold on one second.
Okay.
So we have Aaron Draplin, who's a massive inspiration to me. You can't really see it in my artwork, but he really inspired me with the public speaking, and Debbie Millman, Oliver Jeffers, Lisa Congdon is a friend of mine. She's in the book.
How close are you with Oliver Jeffers? Because I'm trying to get him on my podcast right now, and I'm not hearing anything.
Not close.
Oh, damn.
And yes, there were several degrees of separation. I do not know him at all. I'm lucky that I managed to get him to contribute. I've actually heard that from lots of people. He seems like a person that is very in demand. So
yeah, I'm sure. Well, Stefan Sagmeister kissed me.
He did?
Yeah. So
that's amazing. That's a claim.
Yeah, I've got that. He was at a blogging conference, Alt Summit, that I was at, and I think he was turning it into an art project. He was basically just kissed everybody that he met, and he documented it. And so I was like, I'm getting in there, because I was a designer for years and years, right? So I'd known about him for years, and here he was doing the keynote. And so I have a photo of him kissing me. So he's not in my book, but kissed me. So there.
But that's maybe one level up from being in your book.
You know, I had to do a little. I had to do a little name dropping. You got Oliver Jeffers for crying out loud. So
yeah, I was very lucky about that.
Okay, and then so this is the chicken and the egg situation for me. So what came first, like the podcast, the speaking, the book?
With the book and the podcast.
Yeah, and like what came first?
I always kind of say, like, one of the so even just backing up, like, through the business books and marketing and kind of changing my views on how business and art are really not mutually exclusive. You know, I'm not the only person to say that, but I still think there's a real myth surrounding that. And I think that, by the way, just so I don't go crazy ADHD, here's my logic in starting in that place.
Okay.
I'm just going back to how I built an illustration career. And I did that before I ever started a podcast or started helping people, really. I had a pretty, I had a really legit illustration career under my belt before I ever started the podcast. And it really came from that season of hitting rock bottom and having to try to, you know, I feel like a lot of people when they start their art career thing, I feel like if they're onto something that's kind of in the vein of the direction they should be taking, they get beginner's luck at the start, and you might get a little lucky, you get some lucky breaks, but eventually you hit the dip, as Seth Godin would say, where, you know, all of a sudden you don't really have any natural momentum, and it's all up to your own kind of blood, sweat, and tears and know-how and strategy. And I think that the thing about art is that for so long, all of our magazines, it's like if the business world only put lottery winners on the front of their magazines, and, you know, all of the, and I'm not saying that, the artists that have succeeded are not talented. It's just that for so many of the ones that we celebrate are the super crazy successful ones that kind of won. They might be as talented as all kinds of other people, but they kind of, you know, their thing went viral.
Yeah.
Or they won the creative lottery. And so many of the magazines that I'd read in the art world were, you know, they would say, well, how did you do it? And their answer would always be like, there isn't really any way. It's just, you know, if it's meant to be, you know, the fairy art mother shows up and, you know, overnight you're, that's what happened to me. I don't know how that happened. I got lucky, I guess. And I'm like, man, that doesn't help anybody. And so like, I would be reading all these magazines. That's kind of why I turned to business and marketing, is like, at least they were like, they had a plan.
Yeah. It's like A plus B equals C. It's like, give me some information. Yeah.
Yeah. Give me something I can do, anything. And so, so I also started kind of like studying creative careers, and reading between the lines, because a lot of them wouldn't go the extra step of like understanding the strategy. A lot of them seemed like they couldn't articulate what they did, but if you followed their story and like read their biography or, you know, read about their story, you could kind of see these patterns emerging.
Mm-hmm.
And, all of these things I was like strategically trying to implement into making waves instead of just like going with the flow, which is what I'd done for the past 5 years. And I think all those kind of things that I learned in that time, changed everything for me. And I started doing these personal projects that were essentially, you know, the artist form of content marketing, and was really deliberate about that, to like position myself in a particular, place in the market, in a niche, and really started to kind of take things into my own hands. And from about 2011 to 2013, really established myself as an illustrator, built my client list, got my cash flow going, and that's where really, you know, things started to really solidify. And I had a good salary from about 2013 to now. And, as you know, about a year into solidifying this illustration career, I had this speaking opportunity, and I'd actually bombed like several speaking opportunities in my early 20s. And so I was petrified of doing it. And I thought, I had some really bad experiences, and they're all kind of unique experiences. And for one reason or another, really like bombed. And I had the speaking opportunity, just a little local thing. And this was 2014, early 2014. And I went, because I bombed, I planned like crazy, and just like, I read tons about public speaking. You know, I took my whole like learning about like reading about processes and actually like trying to take your success into your own hands, so to speak, and learn like, what is a good talk? How do you what are all the principles, and how have others gone about doing this, and poured everything into this really little silly talk. And that talk just completely changed my life. And it was after that talk where I was like, I've got to figure out how to systematically make this a part of my illustration career. Instead of, you know, just hoping someone was going to book me at a conference, I decided to start the podcast and create basically an online portfolio of talks.
Yeah, so, proof that you could do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just did one after another. I thought, I'll do at least 100 episodes of this, and somebody's going to be like, you know what? He can probably do a speaking gig. That's kind of what happened.
How many episodes in are you now?
I think we just launched 163 this week.
Okay. And are you, so when you did that little talk that you were totally prepped for,
yes.
So you didn't bomb, obviously. Did you just feel high? Like, did you come off the stage and were like, that was awesome?
My wife was there. And actually, I would say that it's probably the most supernatural feeling that I've ever had in my life. And I felt like it was so palatable. My wife and I were going on a trip right after that, and we got in the car, and we were both kind of like, what was that? That was, and I always feel like, you know, the first part, I'm really obsessed with like the journey and the patterns and what you see, you know, so when someone's like at the heart of their path, like what are the things that kind of show up over and over? And I think one of the things that happens a lot of times is like the first half of the journey is like all blood, sweat, and tears, no supernatural guidance. No, you know, you're just kind of like, you know, trying to figure it out by any means necessary. And I feel like illustration in a lot of ways is kind of just like a natural thing that I developed. It doesn't, even though I love doing it, it's still a massive part of my life. And now it's kind of like a meditation for me. And it's like this weird thing that I've, my, you know, my weird style is like a thing that I've mastered. I haven't mastered illustration, but my own weird way of making it, I'm like, I know how to get into the zone with it. But to me, it felt like a really in the natural sort of journey. Mm-hmm. Whereas the second that I did that talk, everything since then regarding the podcast and speaking and all that jazz has had a bizarre kind of supernatural element. And even that day, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And my wife too, who was there, we were both just like, that tasted like something we've never tasted ever. And we've got to figure out how to, you know, and at first I was like scrambling. I was like, I have no idea what to do with this information. Mm. And it took me like 6 months to start a podcast and figure out a strategy on what to do next. But
well, I was going to say that because, you know, I find that when you look at other people, like me as the Jaws curator, I can look at other artists and I can tell them what they should do. Like I can see the pattern. I can see, you know what I mean? But then when it comes to me and my own artwork, I'm like, I don't know. Like it's,
yes.
But, and people are like, yeah, but you're the Jaws curator. You've written books. Don't you know how to do this? And it's like, well, I could tell everybody else how to do it. And I am working really hard to apply all of those learnings to myself as well. And I mean, it is working, but it's hard to really see hard. Those patterns in yourself. Do you find it much easier to see it in other people than yourself?
Absolutely. Yeah. 100%. Actually, you know, because there was a giant demand for it, I started opening these slots where I would talk to people about their creative careers. And, you know, I'm still to this day uncomfortable with the idea of consulting on someone's career in any manner, mainly because I think this is a sector in the market right now that is quite unsavory in a lot of ways, and people taking advantage of that situation. Not everybody, but plenty of people. And I feel like, you know, I've been extremely cautious about navigating into those dicey waters. But at the same time, you know, I heard something a few years ago. John Acuff talked about how, you know, in every area of our life, we have professionals to help guide us, whether that's our emotional health with therapists or our physical health with doctors. But, you know, the thing that we do from age 20 to, you know, age 60, you know, the thing we do the majority of our life, we have no guidance at all. Like, you know, the majority of people have no real professional guidance on their career after they graduate college.
Yeah.
And it, they're just navigating this thing, but they're so, you know, it's like, I always talk about, you know, someone with an outside perspective can really help you find that mall map, you are here sticker, you know, where you are in this kind of journey. And without that perspective, it's pretty much impossible to navigate. I feel like, often I talk about it like this, like your face is like stuck. I actually have like a billion different ways to articulate the same thing. So one of the ways is I think about like, you're like an ant in your career on a dot to dot page, and you're like searching all over the place for the next dot. But if you get someone with a little bit of distance, you know, they can kind of look back at the dots that you've already hit, and the bigger picture kind of just like illuminates. Like, you know, after you hit a few dot to dots, you can kind of see where the trajectory is going and help you make, you know, progress quicker. And so I actually, even though I've been really cautious about it, and I, you know, like this week, a few weeks ago, I haven't been teaching. I haven't been doing any of those calls. I've been focused on books and illustration clients and the podcast. And with all the demand and everything, I opened up a few slots for this, for these one-on-one sessions. And, you know, they're just like the best thing in the world to step into someone's world, study what they're doing, figure out kind of what the trajectory is that they're too close to see.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of the most satisfying things in my life, even though it's incredibly difficult to schedule it.
Right. Anyway, well, if you could do all your things, well, what do you think your next dot is? Do you know yet?
Yeah, I think my next thing is to, you know, the last book that I did was an anthology, and I've never really written a book. I think you've been in the exact same shoes as me, basically. Mm-hmm. By reading some of your book, realizing that, you know, collecting stuff and then going from that to like writing. I feel like the next stage is publishing this book that I've been working on in one way or another for the past 2 or 3 years. And I think that the problem is with the publishing industry is that print is kind of such a tough space. Even though I've done books, I have other publishers coming to me. I feel like this day and age, I feel like you have kind of two situations that publishers are really stoked about jumping on board. The first one is it similar to something that was already crazy successful? That mm-hmm. that gives them comfort. And, you know, I know that it's easy to like judge publishers and record labels for that reason, but, you know, they're just trying to figure out like, where's the market going? And I don't really want to do that. And the other side of it is, you know, the majority of people, it seems like, that get a good publishing deal have that material kind of prove itself online first.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm kind of, I have this kind of different book that I want to make about creative careers. And, you know, it's been kind of a struggle to articulate it to the publishers in a way that kind of made sense to them. So I've been trying to figure out this idea just kind of has been a burden on me. I'm completely obsessed with it and passionate about it, but I've been so, it's been such a wild ride to try to figure out how it wants to be, you know, manifested into the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I've made some kind of big leaps in the past couple months, so I'm excited about that. But basically, the short answer to that is to actually, like, have more of a written book, even if it's, like, handwritten with pictures or whatever.
Mm.
That's 100% authored by me. That's going to be about creative careers and navigating that journey.
That's awesome. Can you even imagine, like, if somebody had told that kid who was shoving his head into the couch, like, that you'd be speaking? And so now when you speak, are you nervous or are you, like, good to go?
Now, that's a really good question because, you know, like in high school, I wouldn't even be that nervous about public speaking. But the funny thing is, I'm so passionate about creative people and I'm so passionate about my speaking opportunities that I get kind of petrified before I do them. And the minute I step on stage, there is like a very bizarre, cool, calm peace that overcomes me every single time.
Mm-hmm.
But leading up to that second, I am a complete and utter mess. And not because I'm nervous that it's going to, not that I feel like, you know, I'm going to like bomb or something. It's that I'm going to miss the opportunity because like I feel like in the weirdest, you know, without getting overly magical or mystical or epic, which is something I'm, you know, prone to do, it just feels like what I'm supposed to be doing. Like when I do that, every time I do a talk, I take it so seriously because I just feel like this is what I'm here to do. I'm here to go do that. And maybe I'm not saying that it's extremely special. I'm just saying that it's special to me. And as little of purpose as it is, I take it so seriously that I get nervous about, you know, it's like, you know, game day. It's like, all right, I get super nervous, but I do think a lot about, you know, speaking back to you, talking about the kid putting his head in the couch. One of the things I think a lot about is like sending my conscious mind back into the past and telling little, you know, 5-year-old Andy, like, hey man, your illustrations, your characters are going to be on Nickelodeon one day. Like I've done a bunch of work with them. And I always just think like, man, if 8-year-old Andy that felt like he was doomed would know that he was going to draw weird monsters that were going to be, on the Nickelodeon, was going to be on Nickelodeon.
That's so. Yeah, that is just so cool. And I mean, Oh, it makes you just want to hug that little Andy and be like, don't worry, buddy.
It's going to be all right.
It's going
to
be okay.
You're not going to have to go, you know, living in some kind of institution.
Yeah, that's right.
It's going to be all right, man.
Well, you know, I am exactly, like when you're describing speaking stuff,
yeah.
I am exactly the same way. Like, have you spoken at Pixar before?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you should.
I would absolutely. I'm insane. I'm an insane Pixar fan. So
yeah,
that would be
a good, I'll introduce you to my contact there. But I went there the first time after Creative Block came out. And I was like, what the hell am I doing at Pixar? And I was sweating, like I had sweat pouring down the sides of, and I was just like, this is mortifying. And then I step on stage and it's just like, it's just the adrenaline. And like, I'm not nervous and the stories are flowing and it's all good. And then you step off and it's just this weird dreamy thing that you're like, whoa, was that me?
Almost like an out-of-body experience.
Totally. And then the next time I talk anywhere, I freak out again. And I know in my logical brain that the minute my foot steps on stage, I'll be fine. But
yes.
I don't know why I can't talk myself off the ledge leading up to it. You know, like maybe it's that nervous energy that you need to have or something.
I think, yeah. You know, I've heard it explained a bunch of different ways. And, you know, I've heard people say it just means like when you feel that, just think, yeah, it's because I'm going to do something that matters, and that's good. Like, you know, just enjoy that you're taking it seriously and that you're feeling it, and that it means that, you know, the opposite of that is my worst nightmare. Like, my literal worst nightmare in 99% of my life has been about avoiding boredom.
Yeah.
And that, like, you know, anxious, excitement, nerve, whatever, is definitely the opposite of boredom for me. I would trade it any day than being, you know, stuck in a box that, you know, makes my skin crawl. So
yeah, no kidding.
Every time I'm feeling it, I'm just trying to, like, say, hey, man, you're alive. You're doing it. You're doing stuff that is, like, pushing you. Like, you're doing a life that, you know, is not wasted by pushing to your limits. And I try to just enjoy that ride.
Yeah, and it's so cool because it's not just a ride about you. Like, you're helping other people hopefully avoid things that you went through, right? Like, if you'd had somebody be able to guide you. And so I'm totally putting you on the spot here. But I know everybody that's listening is going to be like, tell me what to do. So do you have any off-the-cuff tips that you can give people, like, as far as, you know, because you do hear so many artists say, yeah, but I'm not good at business, or so what, you know, so do you have any, like, go-to tips that you give people about that stuff?
I absolutely do. So
excellent.
The book that I'm working on, the majority of it is kind of like finding your path creatively. Like, that's kind of like the main focus, because I felt like it took me, you know, about 10 years from the start to really feel like I'd found the pulse, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always obsessed with, like, what are the signs? Like, what are the signposts that point you, like, what are you looking for out there in the world that point you to what you should be doing? And I think, I talk about it like recalibrating your compass, because I think we have this, what we're looking for is kind of flip-flopped. And so I think there's two signposts that we know we're supposed to look for. One is like how we interact with, you know, doing a thing, like whether we're talented at something, or like, you know, whether we enjoy it, whether we're passionate about it, whatever. And then the other side of it is the feedback that we get from other people. But I think that we kind of judge these things in an opposite way. And so I always say, you got to recalibrate your compass, because when it comes to the stuff that you do, I think we're looking for insane quality doing something that, you know, we want to, like, pick up a guitar and just be like, doodly doodly doodly, like, oh my gosh, this guy's the biggest, you know, a prodigy. We're looking for this, like, crazy instant quality. And I actually think you got to flip your compass around to quantity and think, what's the stuff that I can just do infinitely? You know, I will give a crazy quantity of time and energy to it, because I just get lost and obsessed with it. I feel like that's a better road sign pointing to your path than pure talent. So I always say, like, we have a crazy tolerance for I would go with tolerance over talent most of the time, because I think it's more about something you're willing to stick at and really dive deep in. And then, so I think that's the first way that you got to recalibrate your compass and the quality versus quantity thing. And then when it comes to feedback, I feel like we do the exact opposite. So I feel like we're always looking for what's the thing that I do that like millions of people are crazy about, or, you know, what's the thing I put on Instagram or the thing I put on YouTube that, you know, I get like, it goes viral and I get like a million hits on it. Like, that's the thing we think we're looking for. That's the sign that we're on the right path. And I would say, instead of looking for that quantity of feedback, actually quality feedback is way more important. You know, likes, I always say like chase the comments, not the likes. Like, likes are a really bizarre metric. I think that why people like something on Instagram or on Facebook or whatever, I think the psychology there is pretty strange and not very telling. But I feel like, you know, even the quantity of comments, but the quality of comments, you know, what are the things that you've done in your life that, you know, where people have cried or they were moved or they, you know, died laughing, or it was something where when they interacted with it stopped them in their tracks and they had to comment on it. And actually looking back, I realized that, I'm not actually insanely happy with the term pep talk, because I think of myself more as like a strategist, mm-hmm. but that, you know, looking back at my life, the biggest kind of, signs in the road pointing towards like ultimately what I've ended up doing and where I feel like the magic is, were these like strategic pep talks that I did with friends, you know, early 20s. There were like a handful of people that, I don't want to like gloat or something, but, you know, these were signs. Like, there's a handful of people that I would do these little strategic pep talks with them, and they would, you know, go back to school and go get a degree and go into their passion, or, you know, start a business and end up doing all these kind of crazy things by an ability to like strategically help people with these pep talks. And I feel like looking back in my past, the quality of feedback was there, where they were like, man, I don't know what you did, but you just like set a fire off in me and did, you know, and I ended up doing crazy things. And so that's kind of the main thing, is I feel like recalibrate your compass. Look for the tolerance instead of talent, which is all about fixed mindset versus growth mindset. Like, your fixed mindset says you only have like this exact level of talent and it's not going to change, or this exact level of IQ. And so you've got to prove yourself and it should come easy to you, rather than really the people that end up winning are the people that have that growth mindset that say, I'm going to find something that I really love and I'm passionate about, and I'm going to work at it until I'm great at it.
Mm-hmm.
That's my main thing, is because that's the thing that I wish that information had been there 10 years ago for me, because I feel like I wasted a lot of time with the jacked up compass.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do. And I think social media really plays into that. You're totally right. I sold a piece on Etsy years ago when I first started dipping my toe into actually showing people that I made work again. And I'd done a piece with a bear on it. And a bunch of other stuff.
I know where this is going. Sorry. I didn't mean to.
I know. Etsy 2009. And so I had done a bunch of pieces, put them up, but then there was this one with a bear. And it sold immediately. And I hadn't sold work since university. And so it sold. And then I got a whole bunch of people emailing going, can you do another bear? Can you do another bear? And so I was like, okay. So I started doing all these bears just to sell them. But like, I didn't care about bears. And so I just sort of felt like, well, I sold maybe three or four more. And then I was like, I don't want to be the bear lady, you know? And even though there was a demand for it, I just stopped making them because I was like, no, I don't want that. Yeah. And so it's like, yeah, that matter of like, but it's hard not to get wrapped up in that, right? Like, people like it. They want to give you money. Like, it's confusing.
And I always say, like, you know, when it comes to your gifts, when it comes to like, you know, your superpowers, like, it is important that they do something for other people, and that, like, you know, if you have something weird about you that doesn't help anybody, it's just called an abnormality. If you have something weird about you that helps other people, it's called a superpower. So I do think, like a lot of artists, I think they, you know, they bash this idea that your art, or they say, they kind of perpetuate this idea that your art is all about you, just shut out all the critics, shut out everybody else. And I don't think that's true. But I think what you're describing is like, you know, the bear thing or likes on Instagram. I think a lot of that, like that often has more to do with like what's already popular.
Yes.
Like I think a lot about like when I like something on Instagram, it's usually like, oh, I like that because it reminds me of other stuff that I already like. So I already, it's not, there's no thought in it. It's just like, oh, I like that. Of course I like that. That like hits me on, you know, how I identify as a person or what I identify as my taste. When I like something, it's usually about something that I already know about myself.
Mm-hmm.
But the things that I feel like the creative's job is to show us things that we don't know about ourselves, is like to do the work, the internal work and like the self-actualization as a creative person to really dig deep and like unearth these things about themselves that are these, you know, like stand-up comedy or a great song will tell you something that you didn't know about yourself. Like we're benefiting from the work that they're doing in their own lives. And they're like doing the work in us super quickly, like supercharged. So you hear the song and it moves you because you're like, oh, I didn't even see that. It's like this mirror that shows you something you've never seen before. And that always deserves more than a like or, you know, a quick purchase. And that kind of depth, it actually takes, it's really rare that that level of depth sets off like a viral chain reaction, because I think the viral chain reaction is about kind of like, it's like the thunder to lightning that's already struck. It's like, oh, it was in the right place at the right time, and it just kind of like followed up on the zeitgeist of the moment. But whereas I think like the creative work that is more tried and true that you can build over a lifetime is kind of like the slow build, really finding those things, doing the deep work about who you are and putting that into your work, and slowly but surely doing the Kevin Kelly thing, the finding your 1,000 true fans, and that being like the mustard seed that turns into, you know, a bigger audience and a more passionate audience. But I always think about when it comes to audience, think about the quality of the connection, which you have a lot of control over, rather than the quantity of the connection.
Mm-hmm. I think that's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. That should know how prepared I was for that question. I've been thinking about this stuff for 10 years.
You were ready. Yeah. Well, I was just saying to somebody the other day about, I can't remember if this was on a podcast or if I was just randomly talking to somebody without it being recorded, but I was talking about, because my collages are really simple and, you know, part of my fear when I started first putting them out, I mean, I loved them and I felt like they were, you know, the culmination of years and years of being a designer and then this, and then, you know, realizing X, Y, and Z about myself. And so they felt like finally I'd struck gold for myself. Mm-hmm. But I was nervous to put them out because like, they're so simple. And what if people are like, oh, it's just like a blob of paint. And, you know, and then somebody pointed out to me that I'm 44 years old, and they said, yeah, you know, the piece might take you 15 minutes, but it's actually taken you 44 years and 15 minutes.
Yes.
And that was a weight off my shoulders. Like, I felt 100 pounds fall off my shoulders because it was like, yeah.
Yes.
That's effing true, you know?
I've heard a story, actually, about, I think there's a story about Picasso where he's at some situation where he's doing, like, these drawings, these quick drawings for people and charging them, I don't know, a few hundred bucks or whatever it is. And he does this quick drawing and the guy's like, I got to pay for that. Like, you did that in 5 minutes. He's like, no, that drawing took me my whole life to draw.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's totally true. Yes.
It's so absolutely true. And I think, you know, I've talked to students a lot and I find that I was just actually at the University of Wisconsin for a week, which was so cool, and got to teach a bunch of classes and hang out with them for the week. And, you know, I was saying, like, you have to make, and I mean, I know, like you said earlier, like, this gets said a lot, but, like, you got to make a lot of crap.
Yes.
You've got to make a lot of stuff that sucks and, you know, gets tossed out, and but it evolves, and it turns into something else, and it turns in it. It might take 10 years for you to hit that eureka moment internally. It might not be a eureka moment on Instagram or a eureka moment, whatever, but you stepping on that stage and rocking it and realizing, like, oh, here we go. Or me landing on this type of work that I've been doing for the last 2 years, and it's just like, well, all right, you know,
yes.
Or even Jealous Curator for me was like a eureka moment. And I was just at home by myself with a 2-year-old at the time, but it felt like, oh, I don't know what this is, but this is going to change my life, you know, and you have to do a whole bunch of stuff before you get to that. You can't just wake up one morning and flip on your computer or walk into the studio and be like, ta-da, I'm here.
And actually, like, that's kind of like the thesis of my book. It's this idea that, I don't know why, but we're on like a Picasso thing. Picasso has this quote that you've probably heard, you know, it's probably been over, you know, it's probably been lettered over mountains like 8 million times, but it's the most profound quote that I've ever encountered. It's like my jam. And he said that the meaning of life is to find your gift and the purpose of life is to give it away. And I think that the thing about that I love so much is that he says that the meaning of life is to find your gift. And I think for whatever reason in our culture, we think that finding your gift is something you can do in a career aptitude test in like 30 minutes in high school, right? Like, and he's saying the meaning of life, meaning it's a journey. It should be a giant portion of your life spent just trying to figure out what the heck is your gift in the first place.
Yeah.
And just like you're saying, like, and that's kind of what I always tell people is like, the first half of your journey on this planet is to figure out what you're doing here. The second half is doing it. But you're not going to just figure it out with some random, you know, I like, you know, Myers-Briggs and you know, career aptitude tests. You know, I'm a fan of all this kind of jazz, but you're not going to figure out what you're doing here, in 20 minutes. And everybody thinks that, you know, your journey begins, it starts when you find your gift, or that's the start of it. But I always say, like, that's like the finish line of your first journey.
Right.
You're only going to get there by, I always say, if you're not making piles of stuff as a creative, you're doing it wrong. Like, you got to get making stuff. Even if it feels unnatural, even if you're not, you know you're not in your gift.
Yeah.
I love that.
I think we might have been separated at birth.
I know, yeah. Like everything you're saying, I'm like, yes!
I know, me too. And then you're like, oh, and then I step onto the stage and I'm like, yeah, I know.
Oh my gosh,
and I also like pizza.
Oh,
but God. I eat salad as well. I have a gluten situation, so.
Oh, man. Yeah. Sad. You know, gluten-free pizza has come a long way. I'll say that.
Don't even talk to me about that. I don't even want to talk about that. It's not good.
I'm trying to be encouraging.
I know,
right?
I know. This has been awesome, but we still haven't done the not so speedy speed round.
Alrighty, I'm ready.
Okay. Well, you know what I'm going to start with? Favorite kind of pizza.
I don't discriminate against any type of pizza. I can eat the cheap pizza. I can eat the fancy pants French pizza. You know, plop a half cooked egg in the middle of it. I can do all of that. You know, I've eaten pizza in France with the half-cooked egg and goat's cheese and roasted duck. And I've eaten, you know, the hot and ready $5 pizzas. And, I'm grateful for all of them. But I would say that my number one topping is probably goat cheese. I feel like that's just the easiest way to elevate a pie.
Oh, nice. Classy. I was expecting like a classic pepperoni or something.
I love pepperoni. Do not get me wrong. You can tell there's a real passion there. There is. Pepperoni is definitely my go-to jam in a, you know, in your run-of-the-mill joint.
But sure.
If there's goat cheese on the menu. I also love a simple garlic and spinach combination.
Oh.
It's a fantastic, it's really subtle, but it's fantastic.
You really are a connoisseur. If this whole art thing doesn't work out for you, like, you could open your own little pizzeria.
Wouldn't that have occurred to me? Why?
Yeah, that could have been your gift.
Or normal plan B.
Well, the town, I moved back to my little hometown, and my favorite pizza place, of course, closed down shortly after I graduated from high school, and it hasn't been around for years. But then there's this other place in town, and there's a bunch of pizza places, but this one place, and it's just like, it doesn't really look like anywhere I really want to hang out. And then my friend, I've been here for 5 years, she's like, oh, but the same people that used to own Mykonos owned that, and they gave them it's the same recipe. And I was like,
oh my God,
are you kidding me? Like, I've been here for 5 years and you didn't feel it necessary to tell me.
This is like the death and resurrection, like end of an amazing story where you think Harry Potter's dead, all hope is lost, and then all of a sudden out of nowhere, there's this giant turnaround. Like the recipe is still in circulation.
That's right. There's flames. Oh, it's exciting. Gosh. Gandalf is there. No, Gandalf, that's the wrong thing. Dumbledore is alive.
They're all in there.
Yeah, somebody with a beard. Yeah, and so we went there for the first time. Like I told my husband, I'm like, apparently, blah, blah, blah. 6 weeks ago, we went there, and, you know, I'm going to say my hands are very swollen because I have had gluten. It is the same recipe.
Yeah. Oh, man.
I know, and I get pepperoni, double cheese.
Man, yeah. Hey, like I said, and that's why you can't judge a book by its cover when it comes to a pizza shop. You never know. It can look like the most basic, you know, trashy pizza joint, and it could have the best pie of your life.
I know, and I feel bad about that. I should not have judged them.
I honestly have a thing, and again, I don't eat that much pizza these days, but I have this weird thing where every single time I see a pizza place, I'm like really desperately curious to know, like, what kind of pizza are we talking about? I like, like every one, I really want to know. What's going on there?
Oh my God. Okay, I think this might be one of your dots further out. I'm just saying. It could be huge. We'll put a pin in it and we'll see where you end up. Okay.
I'll take that with a road sign, yeah.
Okay. Well, I didn't know that you stopped eating pizza. So one of my follow-up question to that was, because Charlie, my son, loves Would You Rather. So would you rather never eat pizza again or never draw again?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's a really tricky one, and I do still eat pizza. I just try to limit it to it's like a real practice.
Just like four times a week.
Only like, you know, six meals. A week. You know, like I would definitely, if I'm honest, I'd have to say, you know, I'd have to quit pizza and be drawing has my heart definitely above pizza, but. Don't tell pizza that.
Okay, I won't. Favorite movie?
That's a great question. I would say the top two are Spirited Away and Eternal Sunshine are probably contending for number one. They're both dreamy. I have crazy dream life in my sleep. I feel like I live in a dream half the time, and I like how both of those are, you know, basically feel like dreams come to life.
That's cool. I didn't know what's the first one? Spirited Away?
Spirited Away. Yeah, it's a Hayao Miyazaki. Yeah, you know, like Totoro and Kiki's Delivery Service and Spirited Away. It's like it's kind of like a Japanese Alice in Wonderland in a way. It's a very like hero's journey, but she goes into the spirit world, and it's just very like, I like watching both those movies because I literally feel exactly like I'm having a super vivid bonkers dream. and nothing makes me happier. Probably my number one passion above drawing, even. I would pick dreaming over drawing. I have crazy dreams almost every night, and I often wake up feeling like grief about leaving my dream world. And that sounds really extreme. It's true.
Do you write them down?
I don't, but I like savor them. Yeah. I think a lot about them and kind of like, you know, throughout the day, I'll kind of like, you know, remember what the story of that was or whatever.
I have really, really weird dreams too. And I come down in the morning and tell my husband and my son, and they just like stare at me and just shake their heads.
Like, no,
they're like, what? Yeah. My husband's like, you are such an artist. Like, it's just like the weirdest thing. But I like it too. When I was in fourth year, in my BFA, we had to set a thesis project at the very beginning of the year and then, you know, deliver at graduation. And so I have such vivid dreams that I kept a dream journal, and then I would just paint whatever I dreamed.
That's awesome.
And then that way, but I mean, in a way it was really disjointed because none of it, like every night was something else crazy, but the thread that held them all together was the fact that I had dreamt them all. And,
that's awesome.
My school did not agree that that was awesome.
Yeah. Here's the thing. Only crazy dreamers think dreams are interesting. Yeah. Everyone is like, shut up. As soon as you're like, I have this dream, like, shh, unless you're Martin Luther King Jr., we don't want to hear it. Like, that's
well, now that we have found our soul brother sister here, you can call me with your weird dreams and I'll do the same. Andy, listen to this one. It's really weird. There was this snake and then this happened.
Last night I had like 150 spiders in my dream. It was, and they were scary. I don't like spiders, but they kind of all seemed like Muppet spiders, so they were kind of interesting. So
I have snake issues, and I had a big snake dream the other night.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know.
Spiders are like, I'm pretty much arachnophobic. So, we're having fear. We're dealing with something.
Waking up in a sweat. Wake up in the morning, ready to roll. Sometimes I'm like, I wonder how much I actually, like, rested.
You know, Mitch Hedberg, the stand-up comedian, he's actually passed away, but he always says, like, he wishes there weren't dreams because they're so exhausting. He's like, one minute, he's trying to, like, get some rest, and the next minute, he's like, trying to fix a go-kart with his landlord.
Exactly.
I was just trying to sleep.
I know. That's how I feel too. Okay, last question for you. Hang on, I can't see it. It's too dark in here now. Okay, yeah. So you don't think about this for very long. This is one of those association things, okay?
I'm scared now.
I know. Best song at a high school dance.
Oh, it's got to be Boyz II Men. Any Boyz II Men. I'm a massive Boyz II Men fan. Into the Road, On Bended Knee, I'll Make Love to You is kind of inappropriate for high school, but I think they still play it. So.
Did that ever play while you were making sandwich art and your eyes crossed over the ranch sauce?
So messed up. Like, the weirdest version of that. But have I ever made sandwich art? To Boyz II Men? I have definitely made sandwiches to Boyz II Men.
I bet you have. It was probably a magical moment for you. Is that when you proposed?
I was way classier. I had like Cocteau Twins playing or something. So I was, you know, I was pretending that I was really cool. I didn't have my, you know, Boyz II Men. I know probably every note of Boyz II Men.
Oh my God, that's so funny. If I could get it without, you know, without getting in trouble with rights, that's how we would play out this. That's how we'd play out this podcast.
I thought about doing episodes and just rolling the dice, and I actually did a whole episode of Creative Pep Talk where every reference, it was about finding perfect harmony in your creative career, and I went through all four members of Boyz II Men because they are like a harmony group.
Yeah.
And like you need the smarts. And that's Nathan, who has the glasses, and you need, like, you know, the bass tone. You got to have, like, your grounding. That's, like, Michael, who does the, you know, the middle of the song where it's, like, just talking. That's, like, all he does in Boyz II Men. He's like, hey, girl, that guy. And then you got to have the wow factor, which is Wanye, he's the guy at the end when they're singing the chorus again. He's like, ooh, like, all over the friggin' shop. That's where you, like, wow them. So that's how you get the perfect harmony. I don't know what I said about
that. Oh, my God. Here's another book idea.
Yeah, I'll pick
that
one next.
How to be creative thanks to Boyz II Men.
Following the art, the creative geniuses that Boyz II Men are.
Oh, my God. You are hilarious.
I'm something.
You are something. I'm just going to write all this down, and then I'll steal it all, and I'll be like, oh, I've got this idea for a book about Boyz II Men. I just came up with it all on my own.
Share this publisher. Don't get there first. I haven't told them about that book yet.
Okay.
I'm sending an email right after.
Okay, yeah. TM it. Trademark. Andy, this was so fun. It's really late for you, I just realized.
It's only late.
It's bedtime, though, for a lot of people in your house.
It's a long day.
Yeah. Well, this was hilarious. This is the last podcast before the holidays, and what a hilarious, awesome, insightful, just really great way to send everybody off into the holidays. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I had an absolute blast.
Me too. And I'm glad that we know each other now instead of just seeing you on recommended reading lists.
I think we have a few mutual friends based on people that were in your creative block book. And,
yeah, I think we do too. Lisa Congdon's one of them, that's for sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, hopefully we will actually meet in real life one day and we can go get salad.
Yes, let's go. Andy J. Salad.
Andy J. Salad. Living the dream.
Right. It was great meeting you.
You Danielle. Too. Thanks and I will talk to you soon.
Awesome.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Are you still there?
Yes.
I know
the secret podcast trick.
No, I'm really recording. Ah, you can't trick another podcaster with that whole "are you still there" trick. Oh well, I tried. Not that I really needed him to open up too much. That was hilarious. That boys to men thing, oh my God, hilarious. Thank you so much to Andy for letting us behind the curtain, sandwich artist love story and all. Thanks to Saatchi Art for supporting not only this episode, but the entire podcast and my e-newsletter, Art for Your Inbox, for all of 2017. They will be with me in the new year too, as well as a few new artsy sponsors who I am oh so grateful for. And finally, of course, huge thanks to you for listening. And so with that, I will wish all of you a happy, happy holiday. I am off to snuggle in for some gingerbread baking, movie watching, and chocolate eating with my boys. And not to be presumptuous, but if you want to put a little something under my tree, I would be very, very, very grateful for a review on iTunes, because the more of those I get, the more people listen to the podcast and the more fun it gets. So if you happen to be over on iTunes, I would love, love, love that. Okay, enough asking for gifts. Lots and lots of love to all of you and yours, and I will be right back here very soon. In fact, there will be more Art for Your Ear on the first Saturday in 2018. See you then.